Hey, it's good to hear my voice. I'm Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy, a podcast so intimidating my own wife is afraid to listen.
We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Nervously saying words, little surprising fans.
Thanks for joining me. Today we'll talk in some detail about law in general and law in a free society. This is the first part in a 3-week section dealing with law, land, and environmental protections. These are some of the topics people asked me to discuss, so I'm getting to them. They're important, so I'm happy to fulfill the requests. If you have any questions, rebuttals, or topics you would like me to learn you about, contact me and I'll get back to you. Before I get going on the meat of the monologue, I'd like to point out that the questions of how will we have a law in a free society, what will property rights look like, how will the environment be protected, are not ethical justifications for government, and not having answers to these questions does not mean we should then support government. I am coining a new descriptor for questions like these. Here on, I will call these questions cotton-picking questions. As I've described before, as with slavery, the most important question about government is whether or not the institution is ethical. One may have legitimately asked 200 years ago, but without slaves, who will pick the cotton? However, slavery should have been abolished, whether or not they were able to arrive at a satisfactory answer because slavery is evil. In the same way, if government, which relies on the use and threat of violent force on peaceful people to exist, is evil, then it is our obligation as good people to reject government even without knowing precisely how a future without it might function. That's the meaning of cotton-picking questions. I'm sure the phrase will take off and spread across the world in the next couple of weeks. What is law? Most of the first dictionary definitions aren't bad, but usually include some idea of government in them, which doesn't really work for our purposes. I would say the law is an expressed system of rules that regulates interpersonal relationships, which may be enforced by the imposition of penalties. Laws outline the obligations and the limits of human relationships. Laws express how one person should and shouldn't interact with another. One common misconception about laws in our current society, which should be addressed at the beginning of our discussion, is this: laws keep people safe. This sounds true, and it feels true. And for many of us, it is how we always thought about laws. But it's easily, demonstrably false. Laws don't keep you safe. Ultimately, when it comes down to it, a law is a sentence on a piece of paper. It may be a demanding sentence. It may be a sentence which commands you to be safe and to not hurt others. Laws themselves, however, do nothing to actually keep you safe. Objectively, laws consist only of ink and paper. Unless you can give people paper cuts like a ninja with a katana, no law is going to protect you from being harmed by another person. If someone is considering murdering another, knowing there are words which say "don't murder people" written down somewhere is probably not going to sway them not to kill the individual. Surprisingly, I have had some people argue that this is not the case. They have argued laws do keep people safe. They said having words on a piece of paper written down in a government building actually prevents people from murdering other people. They said they thought the law literally kept people from murdering other people. To be honest, they were drunk, so I couldn't get them to explain their position more clearly, and I don't find it convincing. If you happen to be a person of the mindset that having words on a piece of paper saying don't murder is actually itself enough to prevent murder? I'd love to hear your position explained more clearly, because I do not get it. Still, it is true that in the U.S. in 2015, people are generally safe. That's nice. If it's not the laws that keep us safe, what does? One of the first things that keeps us safe is the fear of repercussions for hurting other people or taking their property. This is one legitimate function of police. While a law doesn't prevent a crime, a fear of law enforcement very well may. If people know there is a good chance they will get caught for murdering someone else and face a lifetime in prison or being killed themselves, then it is much less likely they will actually go through with it. The same goes for other real crimes against people, like destruction of property, theft, fraud, etc. The fear of negative repercussions prevents a lot of crime. As I have tried to make clear, insofar as the governments prevent and deter bad actors from acting badly, that is, violating the property rights of others, governments are providing a necessary service to society. I continue to get objections to what I say because I don't talk about the good things government does. So I should probably acknowledge they do some good things in the world too. The major problems with government's provision of such services are they do a poor job of it, they have a violent monopoly on service provision, and they force everyone to pay for their services. Ironically, government becomes an armed robber in order to prevent armed robbery. When I think about things in that light, it's sometimes hard to believe I ever thought government was the best way to keep society civil. Another thing which keeps people from being victims of crimes is defensive force. Sometimes people try to hurt other people or steal from them and are stopped in the moment by the person they are violating or by someone else close by. Some perceive this to be the job of the police, but rarely does law enforcement actually prevent a crime from occurring in the moment. Insofar as they do, good for them, but mostly the people who are naturally closer to the potential crime are going to be the ones keeping it from happening. If people are known for being capable of defensive force, it is less likely they will be subjected to a violation of their rights. If I were a thief, I probably wouldn't try to burgle a house insured by Smith & Wesson or pickpocket an MMA fighter. I suppose these scenarios are related to the last one. Force may simultaneously prevent me from committing a crime and be a negative repercussion for my attempt. One thing that keeps people safe in the United States is that, historically, people are mostly pretty rich. There are a lot of poor people, not going to deny that, but we're living in a different world. Even the people deep in poverty have electricity, running water, indoor plumbing, not to mention cable television, internet, and cell phones. Poor now does not mean the same thing as poor 500 years ago, a time when even the richest of people had no idea a thing like electricity was even possible. As a result, people have less of a need to steal to survive. Even the homeless have no need to steal in order to survive, for the most part. I know this from some conversations I've had with others, and some from my own experience. One time in the middle of winter, I had some friends drop me off in downtown Minneapolis with nothing except some winter clothing, a Bible and a journal, and a cell phone so when I was finished, I could have someone pick me up. I wandered around for a while trying to figure out what to do. At 3 a.m. in my wanderings, a man told me two things. One, I needed to get out of this area now. I didn't ask why. I was too tired. And two, where I could find a place to sleep on the next night. After I found a place to stay, I also found a place to eat two meals a day. And there I got a hat for my cold head, and also found out information about many other places to get free meals, all within a couple miles of where I was. In 36 hours, I went from having functionally nothing to having a warm bed and meals in perpetuity. I tell that story just to illustrate a very simple point. In a society as rich and as generous as ours, even the homeless can survive without hurting other people, without the need to harm others for food, water, and shelter. People are less likely to do so. Even without the fear of punishment, people are generally kind. I think this is the number one thing protecting people from people. I want to be a good person. I don't want to hurt other people. I don't want to steal their stuff. I'm guessing you want to be a good person to other people too. You don't want to hurt me. You don't want to take my stuff. The vast majority of the population feels this way. People generally don't violate the non-aggression principle because they don't want to treat other people like that. They generally don't physically harm other people unprovoked. They generally don't steal from other people or destroy their property. They tend to follow through on their contracts with other people. For the most part, people are civil toward one another. I understand there are many exceptions to the rule. Millions of people violate other people and their property, and would do so even more if they didn't fear repercussions for their actions. But these exceptions are just that. They are not the norm. However, any society does need a way to deal with these exceptions, a way of handling people who forego decent and civil behavior to violate the rights of other people for their own gain. But simply having laws won't be enough to deter them. Again, laws don't keep you safe. Laws are words on a piece of paper. Words on a piece of paper do not keep you safe. Things like the general wealth of a population, fear of defensive force and repercussions for crimes, and most people desiring to treat each other well anyway, are some of the more powerful factors in explaining what keeps people in a society safe. So if law doesn't protect people, what is the purpose of law? Well, the purpose of laws under a government are to control the behavior of their citizens by making it explicit to those people what things they must do, what things they can do, and what things they can never do. In some cases, these laws and the enforcement of them can be helpful, but many times the laws of the government just succeed in making criminals out of people who have committed no real crime. They have a lot of rationalizations for their hundreds of thousands of laws, which have nothing to do with keeping people safe from one another. They have lots of explanations for their enforcing of laws against people who've done nothing to violate the rights of another person. But ultimately, the enforcement of laws related to victimless crimes is horrible. The so-called criminal may not be acting morally, depends on what he or she did, but if there is no victim, they have not committed a crime. In the case of victimless crime enforcement, the real victim becomes the person the government calls the criminal, and the real criminal is the law enforcer. If you're looking for the creation of an ethical law code, the government will not provide it for you. The nature of being a monopoly, which forces itself upon an entire region, makes a government creation of ethical laws impossibly improbable. Personal protection from rights violation is way too important to leave in the hands of a monopoly created and maintained through rights violations. When the government is being a criminal, what recourse do you have? You can vote every few years. This level of accountability is a joke. It's like being given a super soaker and then being told to quench the flames of a roaring forest fire. I suppose thus far, I have merely told you what you already know. I think the government sucks. What about law in a free society? How does that work, or how could that work? I will remind you of this frequently, even if it annoys you. I don't know how it will work. One of the premises of supporting government is the belief that a small handful of people have the wisdom, foresight, and integrity to justly wield power to control hundreds of millions. Anarchy is the rejection of such a premise. Anarchists are not so utopian or so willing to sacrifice the rights of billions so that the powerful can rule over them. I'm not arrogant enough to think I know what the most effective manner of lawmaking and enforcing will be in a free society. But I do have some thoughts, and I hope this will be a decent general overview. The purpose of law in a free society is to specify the terms of human relationships with one another. Laws outline how one man should interact with another, and what the limits of such interactions are. Some laws need to be spelled out explicitly, others don't. I'm not convinced we even need laws covering the basic tenets of the non-aggression principle. Everyone knows not to hurt other people. Everyone knows not to take their stuff. These are ethics universally understood that even children can clearly comprehend. Honestly, if a society doesn't generally agree to the non-aggression principle, that's going to be a huge mess whether or not you have a government. If anyone does not think the non-aggression principle is applicable, I suggest you promptly slap them across the head and take their wallet, then gently ask them what they think about the applicability of the NAP now. These are things self-evident enough, it seems like an unnecessary step to spell them out, but if a society thinks they need to do it, they can certainly find a way. One thing which needs to happen in any society is to figure out who owns what. This isn't an issue unique to anarchy, but some sort of series of systems need to be in place to determine ownership. Thankfully, this shouldn't take much imagination as to how ownership could be determined in a free society, because people now have largely freely solved this problem anyway. There are invoices for products going from a manufacturer to a retailer, deeds for land, titles for vehicles, receipts for all purchases, electronic records, and the like. These mechanisms trace ownership and provide the owner strong evidence for their claim on a particular object. I know people don't tend to think about it this way, but receipts are like tiny, cute little baby laws outlining right and wrong human behavior. A receipt is a law that says, "I own this." By implication, it also means you don't own this. My proof of ownership is words on a piece of paper which outline the parameters of our relationship. I have a right to determine what happens with what I purchased, and you do not. If you break into my home and take it from me, whatever it is, let's say it's a small wooden block. I am a simple man with simple tastes. If you took my block from me, the receipt is a law which helps me determine and prove a theft has occurred. A receipt can be a helpful tool for evidencing ownership in a free society, but it is just as powerless as any government law in preventing theft. We still need mechanisms for safety and crime prevention in a free society. The best preventative measure is probably decent parenting. The second best is probably everyone in the world being rich, but these are even more outside of my expertise than theorizing about a free society. The third best mechanism for preventing theft is a combination of preventing the thief from stealing or catching the criminal after the act. There are many ways to do this. I could get together a neighborhood crime prevention team to keep track of and deal with any suspicious activity. I could booby trap my house so at night or when I am away, anyone breaking in through a window or a door would be immediately disabled. I could become skilled with a gun to defend my house when I'm around, and have someone else stay at my house when I'm away. I could install cameras to help identify anyone who came into my house. I could put up a fence with a locked gate and razor wire all over the place. I could bar the entry points. I could set up landmines in my lawn. You think a thief is going to try to steal a wooden block if he might explode? Now that's a deterrent. I really don't want to do any of this. I barely remember to lock my doors when I leave now. I'm probably not going to remember to activate the landmines. You know what I want to do? I want to hire someone to protect my property. I'd like to hire a whole organization who specializes in providing security for people and their stuff. You know what I would like from the people I hire? I would like them to be held accountable if my property is damaged or stolen, or if someone on my property is hurt. It is their job to protect me, after all, and if they do not protect it, then I am not receiving the product I pay for. There is already a market for private security. Even though people are forced to pay for police, even if they get private security. Police whose job involves some protection, but also involves the enforcement of a lot of laws which have nothing to do with protection. Without government, this market will boom and innovate to fit customers' desires. Who knows exactly what these companies will look like, but most people I know are going to want themselves and their property to be protected, and they are not going to want to take the responsibility for such protection into their own hands all the time. It is more efficient for them, and it would put their mind at ease, to just have someone else do it. Additionally, for the most part, very few people are going to want to hire a company to protect their stuff, which is not actually held liable for the protection of their stuff. If nothing like this exists when we have a free society, don't worry. I'll start it up and make a lot of money while keeping you safe at the same time. Win-win. Let's say I've hired a security company like this. I've shown them proof of ownership of the house and my wooden block within it. They are then responsible for preventing my wooden block from being stolen. You outwit them, break into my home, and steal my wooden block from me and leave. What happens next? I'll report to them my block has been stolen, and they will reimburse me for the cost of the block and any damage caused by your break-in. Then they will decide what to do next. They may investigate the case to find you and receive reimbursement from you for their costs. Most likely not. The cost of the block would be so low, it wouldn't be worth the trouble to try to find you. What if I wasn't a man of simple tastes with a wooden block, but instead was a leprechaun with a block of gold? What if you stole my gold block? The company would still reimburse me for the replacement cost as per our business arrangement. If they reimburse me for the cost of the gold block, I would likely transfer ownership of it to them, so they now have a rightful claim over the stolen property. Then they would come after you hard. They hire an investigator or use their own investigators and figure out you did it. Now what? There are a few options, and scenarios change depending on how things are worked out. But for sure, the security company is going to come after you, seeking their property back, as well as restitution for all the costs your theft has caused them. Like the investigators, time spent handling my case, sending people to you to seek the item you stole, and the money you cost them when they reimbursed me. If you do not choose to comply with their requests for restitution, things continue to get more complicated. They have the option of using violence to acquire the stolen property. I've had people argue this would be an act of aggression, and that it is a violation of the non-aggression principle, but the aggressive force was used by the thief. Seeking to acquire what the thief stole is not a violation of the NAP, because it is a use of defensive force to prevent one's property from being stolen, or in this case, to defend the property from continuing to be stolen. If someone tried to reach into my pocket to take my wallet, and I grabbed their hand and moved it away, it's an act of defensive force. If they get a hold of my wallet and pull it out of my pocket, having successfully temporarily stolen it, and I grab the wallet immediately and put it back in my pocket, it's still an act of defensive force preventing theft. The same is true if I run into the person a few hours later and get my wallet, or 4 months later, or 4 years later. It doesn't matter how long it took between the act of theft and my defense of my property. It's still not an act of aggression to prevent theft. It's defensive force. In this case, the security company is justified in using powerful defensive force to reacquire their property to prevent a successful theft. But they probably won't do this until they have exhausted other options. They are likely to only use violence as a last resort This isn't necessarily because the company is run by good people. It may or may not be. They are likely to avoid violence because violence is risky and potentially expensive. Violence is costly for a few reasons. Violence carries with it the risk of collateral damage that they would be held liable for if they were thought to be negligent in their force, like damaging the property of others or hurting innocent bystanders. Or they could have been negligent in their investigation and go to the wrong person's house and hurt them. Errors such as these have the potential to wreak financial havoc on a security company because the costs of restitution can be astronomical. A company who resorts to violent force first to acquire stolen property is a company constantly putting its employees in danger. This makes employees less likely to work there and more likely to require higher pay. Not only this, but it is more likely to result in injuries and death to their security officers. Then they lose employees temporarily or permanently, and have to hire more people and new people more frequently than if they use less violence. If they have employees getting seriously injured or dying on the job, they have probably already worked out a deal with them, which will result in having to make massive payments on the regular for injuries suffered in the workplace. A dangerous work environment is expensive in many ways. A third reason using violence as a first resort is a bad idea for the company is consumers don't like violence. For the most part, what kind of security company do you want protecting your house? Do you want one with a reputation of being extra quick on the trigger finger and who uses brutal violence without hesitancy to require stolen property? Do you want one who kills people as a first resort when, say, they think they might be breaking into your house? I don't. I've broken into so many houses I've owned and my friends owned, I'd for sure be dead right now. I don't think most people would want to hire a company like this. They would rather hire more peaceful alternatives who do a good job providing security for their customers. So, rather than break into your house and take back the property, they come to your house. You refuse to give them back the stolen property and pay reparations for the costs your theft has incurred. The security company chooses not to use violence at this point. In this scenario, you haven't hired a security company. My company then offers you up a list of what they deem to be acceptable third-party arbiters, organizations who settle disputes, and asks you to choose one to decide who the property belongs to and whether you owe restitution payments for all the fuss you caused. You decline this option as well. Courts of local peers have been around for a very long time and would likely remain in a free society. The reality is, people have disputes with one another, and they often need some way to resolve them which sounds fair to both parties. As the court system is now what people are accustomed to using to seek justice, they will probably want a court system in the future in place to solve disputes like this. A court involves more people, and so has more costs associated with it than a third-party arbitrator, and so the security company doesn't suggest it as a first option. But they are suggesting it as an option now. You know you're guilty, and the evidence against you is strong, so you know a court will find you guilty. They will compel you not only to give back the gold block and pay restitution, but now you will also have to pay the expensive court fees for making it get that far. So you decline this offer to settle the case as well. You're criminally insane, I guess. It's possible the security company may give up seeking to recoup their losses at this point, and instead damage your reputation by making public their evidence that you are a thief who refuses to be held accountable for your actions and refuses to seek to make things right despite having multiple chances. Maybe they will rely on society refusing to do business with someone like this. It is conceivable such a system of reputation may develop over time in a society which relies on it to punish bad actors. More likely in this scenario, they will use defensive force to acquire their stolen property and the cost of your misbehavior. Because the company has a strong case against you and has evidence you refuse to submit to either an arbiter or a court to solve your dispute, they can prove their justification of their use of force. At this point, having rejected peaceful methods of dispute resolution, you will have very few options to turn to and no ethical justification for your actions. Either by overwhelming you with force or by waiting for your departure and sneaking into your home, the company reacquires the stolen property and some cash to boot, which, again, they can prove you owe them because your actions cost them so much. And there you go. We used our law in the form of receipt, easily provided by the free market, and arrived at something very much like law enforcement, without any sort of government intervention, or laws imbued with special power because they were written down by elected officials. It's just a hypothetical, but I hope you find it at least a plausible explanation of one way society can deal with bad actors without using the coercion of government. We still haven't touched on the primary form of law in a free society, contracts. Contracts are agreements made between multiple parties about how their relationship with each other will function. Contracts are laws outlining the required behavior of each party within the contract. They are laws entered into voluntarily without coercion. Otherwise, the contract was entered into under duress and is invalid. And they have a limited time frame, or provisions which allow the contract to be broken, to provide a way out for both parties, if the contract is no longer deemed acceptable. Contracts are made all the time now, even with a government. Contracts guide relationships between employee and employer, landlord and renter, sales of large items, marriages, any service provider and the person they are providing the service for, and on and on. Contracts would be even more important in a free society without the many government laws, which often override contracts or regulate the language of contracts to make sure they are considered valid by the government. Without the interference of the state, voluntarily entered into agreements play a more significant role. Contracts sound great on the surface as a nice set of guidelines people mutually consent to as a law determining how they must behave in a relationship, especially in an economic one. But I can sense your immediate fear and concern. What happens when someone breaks the contract? Don't worry. We'll figure this out together as I tell you one solution. All major contracts should be insured by a third party. With most of my friends, I'm comfortable not insuring any economic transactions. I trust them. They trust me. We'll be fine. But with strangers or people I don't know that well, I am going to want some assurance the contract will be followed through on. Here's what third-party contract insurance might look like. You and I get together to make a deal. I'm going to rent property from you for $1,000 a month. You write up a contract setting the terms of the rental. I think it's a fair and worthwhile contract for me to sign. But we don't know each other very well, and both of us want this contract insured. So we contact a company who specializes in contract insurance. They look it over and check our backgrounds, and insure our contract for a fee. So we have paid a fee to an insurance company, so now neither of us have to worry about the other person not following through. I'll be the bad guy this time. I've already besmirched your character enough on this episode. I live in your house 3 months and don't pay you anything and trash the place. I'm the worst. Then I leave and go live in a friend's basement. You would be totally screwed, but you got insurance. Here's what the insurance company does. They fulfill the parts of the contract I did not. So you're made whole, and the insurance company lost money on the deal, and now they will be going after me to acquire the money I owe them. It's only a few thousand dollars for them, so they probably won't try very hard. A contract enforcement agency will be able to wield tremendous power over me without using any force. All they need to do is get the word out that I don't follow through on my contracts or pay a reimbursement to make amends on the contracts I break. If they can inform people, especially any other third-party contract enforcement agencies, I'm not a trustworthy person to contract with. I have serious problems. In a society where contracts guide most economic relationships, no one is going to want to contract with me without insurance, and no insurer will insure my contracts, or if they do, only for an exorbitant price. Even after breaking the contract, I will be highly motivated, even without the use of any coercion, to rectify my breach of contract so that I will become someone others are willing to contract with in the future. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for me to find a job, rent property, hire a contractor, have a cell phone that isn't prepaid, get a loan, get a credit card, and on and on. If I am not following through with my contracted commitments, life is going to be very hard for me. This is another example of the free market motivating good interpersonal ethics without the government. Because there is no coercive monopoly interfering in voluntary relationships, people are motivated to interact with each other honestly and treat each other fairly. People are selfishly motivated to treat the person they are contracting with well because it will benefit them in the future. People who have acquired a bad reputation for not fulfilling their end of a contract will be very hard to insure and very expensive to insure in the future. Conversely, people who have acquired a good reputation for always fulfilling their end of a contract will be very easy and very cheap to insure in the future. For the insurance company, insuring someone who always follows through on their agreements would be nearly a no-risk proposition. It would be like providing flood insurance to people who live in a desert. The insurance will be dirt cheap because of the chance of a flood, or in this case, the chance of not following through on contractual obligations, is so low there is almost no risk to the insurer. Contract law will be some of the strongest and most prevalent laws in a free society. It is easy to consider how these laws might be enforced without a government. While it is possible to enforce these laws using violence without violating the NAP, as the prevention of fraud is a use of defensive force, there are actually many potential peaceful solutions which will be effective in most cases. When we eliminate the use and threat of violence on peaceful people that government relies on for everything it does, we discover there is a whole world of potential solutions out there that have never crossed our mind. I hope good and creative problem solvers such as yourself will decide to reject coercion and embrace peace, and help figure out how to organize human society in humane ways. If you have an interest in a private security company, which is functioning now in Detroit, where, despite the very high taxes, police have said they cannot keep people safe, you can look up information about the Detroit Threat Management Center. They are a private security company doing cool stuff, keeping people safe, even in locations where the police cannot. If you're interested in more information about how government services may be provided in a free society, there are a few books in particular you're supposed to read if you're an anarchist, which further explain these ideas. I don't follow their dumb rules, though. I'll get around to it one day. One of these books is called The Machinery of Freedom by David Friedman. This is one I want to read that I haven't gotten around to. I'll also have a link to the article by David Friedman that I have read about efficient law in an anarchic society. The article is academic in nature and isn't necessarily an easy read, but it is brief and clear. I find Friedman's description of the creation of law in a free society to be more restrictive in nature than I would imagine it being. But again, it is impossible to know exactly what law would look like in a free society. He proposes law being created without coercion, without violating the non-aggression principle. So I'm down with it. You can find the book, the article, and a video on the Detroit Threat Management Center on the episode page for this podcast. Just go to www.christianarchy.net and search for episode 11, and the notes for the episode should pop right up like internet magic. as per usual, you can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. Next week, we are going to talk about what is, to me, the most boring topic of the whole podcast thus far, land ownership. I'll be sure to use my boring voice as opposed to my normal, hyper-animated one. Thanks for listening, people. You're real troopers to have made it this far into the episodes. I hope the thought journey has been a rewarding one for you. Live well, love well.